Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and I'm really delighted to be hosting this special series of Emerge Australia podcasts in preparation for Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience and their carers, as well as eminent clinicians working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and associated overlapping conditions. This season is particularly important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign designed to ensure the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives, at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed. To commence today, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. So as we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, never has there been a greater need in my lifetime for the world to celebrate the brotherhood of man globally. A world without stigma, a world without discrimination on any grounds, a world where people have equity of access to treatments and medical care. Imagine a world where we have biomarkers and diagnostic tests for those with ME and associated conditions, and dare I dream a world where we have a cure for these diseases. So today I'm delighted to be speaking with Stacey lives with ME-CFS, EDS and POTS, and is a passionate advocate and speaker dedicated to raising awareness particularly about ME-CFS. Living with this complex and often misunderstood condition, Stacey has transformed her personal journey into a powerful platform for education, support, and advocacy. With a background in communication, Stacey combines her expertise with her lived experience to create meaningful conversations around chronic and complex illness. This podcast aims to shed light on the challenges faced by those with ME-CFS while also celebrating resilience, hope, and the importance of community. Through our candid discussions and insightful interviews, we seek to empower others to share their stories and connect with resources that promote understanding and healing. Stacey is committed to breaking the stigma surrounding ME-CFS and fostering a supportive environment for those affected by chronic illness. Her engaging personality and compassionate approach make her a relatable and inspiring figure in the chronic illness community. Stacey, I'm delighted you are joining me today as we navigate the complexities of life with ME-CFS and in particular severe ME, and for you having the willingness to share your valuable insights.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's so lovely to have you here. And I'm really looking forward to sharing your journey as we speak. And I also want to promote the fact that you share your journey on Instagram, and that is your Instagram page at living.life.with.m.e. and contribute to spreading awareness and understanding of these debilitating conditions. So that Instagram page, for anyone that doesn't have it, is once again at living.life.with.m.e. Hop on it and see Tracy's amazing posts. So welcome. After all of that, I can stop talking. This is fantastic.
Thank you so much. That's such a generous, lovely introduction. And I'm truly so grateful to be able to give a little bit back to Emerge after everything and all the ways that you've all helped me along my journey. It truly has been the game changer in approaching, navigating, having ME-CFS. So thank you.
That's a pleasure. That's what we're here for. So, Stacey, perhaps you could share with our listeners what your personal story with ME, EDS and POTS is, and what impact these conditions have had on your daily life, and also, importantly, sense of identity, because that's critical.
Yeah, it's the impact is huge, and it's something that's so difficult to summarize, I guess. But I think the easiest way is that the difference in my life before compared to where I'm at now. I developed ME-CFS when I was 29 after getting pneumonia. Oh, sorry, 25 after getting pneumonia. But before that, I had been a high school performing arts teacher. I was regularly involved in performing still. My life was so busy. I was working full time, running extracurriculars. I would have my own rehearsals a few nights a week. And I, lived a very full life, engaged in so many aspects of the community. And getting ME-CFS was a significant shift in that I started off with mild ME undiagnosed. Unfortunately, my doctors weren't aware of ME-CFS and that delayed my diagnosis. And I wasn't diagnosed until I was 27 and I declined to a point where I could no longer work. And the change when it was difficult trying to work and I thought I had to push through because I didn't know it was ME-CFS and I was like, oh, okay, I'll try to keep going. And it was incredibly difficult. But then the shift into not being able to work was a significant change after being such a busy person. And I think something I really had to navigate was I'd always tried to have a sense of identity within myself and use the things I did in life as a way to express that rather than attaching my identity to what I did. But when I was no longer able to participate in all of those things, I had to really come back to the fact that everyone has inherent worth within and it's not about what we can do. And with that, also trying to find ways to express myself and to find a purpose in each day to keep me moving forward that was within my capacity, which is obviously incredibly difficult with ME-CFS as your capacity can change and sometimes it's very small. And when I declined further after getting COVID a second time and developed severe ME, I had to move in with my mum for support and I wanted to find a way to express myself, but also in a way that felt meaningful to me, which is why I then decided to start posting on Instagram as just a way to connect with something important to me when I could in a no pressure way. And I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to do that. I know so many with severe ME aren't able to, but yeah, it's definitely been an interesting journey, and POTS and EDS in the mix of things have complicated it as well. But having EDS undiagnosed again, I've had that since I was born. It helped me recognize the shift of what fatigue was, because that was something I'd always experienced, versus the change into ME/CFS. And I think that did help me recognize that there was something different happening in my body and continue advocating for support and diagnosis.
Is any one of these conditions, the ME, the POTS, the EDS, in your body, does it dominate?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely the ME/CFS. So I wasn't diagnosed with hypermobile EDS until after my ME/CFS diagnosis. And it's become more of a challenge now because I'm mostly bedbound and I'm not able to do the exercise and things that I used to, which helped keep everything in place. POTS is also a significant impact on my life, probably just slightly less than the ME/CFS. So my use of a wheelchair is both because of ME/CFS and POTS. My difficulty standing, it's like a gamble of whether or not the ME/CFS or the POTS will stop me first. But the effect of ME/CFS and post-exertional malaise is what is the most impactful for me.
And with regard to any potential treatments that you have or may have had, are there any treatments that, for example, will ease the burden by helping with part of one of the conditions that you've got? So, you know, rather than lumping them all together, sometimes if you can make a little bit of a difference, let's say, to the POTS,
yeah,
it'll make a difference to the ME. Or if you can make a bit of a difference to the ME, it'll impact your POTS. Have you found any of that?
Yes, absolutely. So when I was diagnosed with POTS after having COVID for the first time, I'd had symptoms, but it was manageable before that point. It became unmanaged after COVID and I started midodrine,
yep,
which was amazing. Then I got COVID again and had to increase that. And that truly has been a game changer. It is what allows me to go to the bathroom in the morning in my wheelchair. At one point, I tried to go before taking my medication, and that resulted in needing support from my mum because just sitting up was too difficult for my body. So that has a huge impact. Unfortunately for my body, I also have MCAS and react to medications. So it means certain things don't always work for me. And so I have tried other things, or we've discussed certain things, and that does add a level of complexity in that. I tried a medication to lower heart rate, which I loved, but my body not so much. And I had to come off that, unfortunately. But I do believe that any little bit that can help makes a big difference, because there's so many aspects to ME/CFS alone. But then when you look at all the common comorbid conditions, there are so many factors and every little bit helps. And with the EDS, not medication specific, but aids help. So getting a bed with a mattress and that adjusts to help my joints made a huge difference in my level of pain while resting. Getting the right size wheelchair to use, again, made a huge difference in that level of pain. And there's, unfortunately, you need to be able to access those medications and that equipment.
Readily available. They're not
exactly.
Not necessarily always available. you know, just through a script. It might be an offline production. It's very challenging.
It is, and it's expensive too.
Yeah,
when for people that can't,
expensive, you know.
Yeah, and for a population that can't work, there are so many factors to consider with all of it. And I know for me, a big factor, particularly in medication, is like I have to weigh up the potential reaction versus the potential benefit, because I have a long history of reacting to medications and things. And so that, yeah, there's so many, it's not as simple as, oh, here, try this, for lots of people, unfortunately.
So you touched on something before. I had a discussion very early this morning with Dr. Alexis Kutchins from New York, and she touched on something that made a lot of sense. She talked about, why is it that people are getting infection after infection after infection, and talked about, you know, if families, you know, children in families, if you, when you were young, you kept getting infection after infection, that, you know, somehow that is an interesting pattern that might be, you know, because we don't really understand why, you know, why did the body's battery decide to suddenly not work? You know, we don't really understand that, whilst we've got far more understanding of the mechanisms now. We don't really have a good understanding, which begs the discussion, which is not for now, but the discussion that says, what should parents do with their children to avoid them getting sick or avoid infection? And it's a fascinating, you know, it's like this goes with this goes with this goes.
Yeah. I actually, it's really interesting that you said that, because I reached out to a local representative a few weeks ago about supporting kids and about prevention. And because with all the discussions about NDIS at the moment and the increased needs of support and everything, infection and obviously the recent events over the past few years is something that hasn't been touched on in the increased needs for support. And I reached out and said, you know, rather than looking at just the outcome, we can look at prevention. And there's a lot of stigma and difficulty around. Lots of people struggled in 2020 with changes, and people do want to move on. And I understand that. But the way I look on preventing and minimizing the risks of infection is the same as sun protection. Like, we know there's a significant risk of things like skin cancer and sunburn and heat stroke and the various levels, but we learn to live with that. And there's no hat, no play, slip, slop, slap, like all those things. And so I reached out and asked if there are supports from a school setting to look out for children and to help keep them safe. And she was great. And she reached out to the Department of Ed, got back to her and passed on some information. And I can't remember specifically at the moment, and I don't want to pass on any misinformation.
That was just one of the areas that I digressed into, because that's where brain went while I was listening to you speak.
It's definitely important.
Sometimes it's a bad thing for me to do. Yeah, look, and education and kids, you know, looking for the root cause and then trying to see, because it is for future generations as well as it is for people who currently have ME. And in this case, we're really talking about people living with severe ME. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Are there common misconceptions that you've come across about ME or severe ME that you encounter? And how do you think increased awareness can help change public perception?
Definitely. I think there's obviously the lack of overall public understanding of it does play a significant role in access to the right supports and diagnoses and things. But the thinking that it's chronic fatigue has probably been one of my most significant challenges. in the early days, I had lots of comments along the lines of, oh yeah, lots of people have that and they're fine. They just push through. And I had experienced what chronic fatigue felt like living with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And I knew what it was like to push through. And I knew that sometimes it could be significant, but it's so different with ME/CFS. And the hard thing is as well, when I was first diagnosed, I didn't know how to say myalgic encephalomyelitis. And like, that's exactly. And that's a hard word. So obviously, chronic fatigue syndrome is easier to say when people don't know what ME/CFS is. And that can make things really, really tricky. And the next part of things is when the way you have to navigate living with ME/CFS, being in bed all the time, in a dark room, hardly able to interact with people, that often gets considered as mental health concerns. And that it's understandable because obviously that's how commonly those things are associated. And it can make it really challenging for people navigating ME/CFS when they're told, oh, a bit of sunlight will help. And it's like, I want to go sit in the sun. I would love that. I would love to have visitors. I would love to not be in bed all the time. It's not that I recognize all the benefits of those things and would love those things, but they have a physical
impact.
And I think that's something that society just doesn't understand. They just know it's bad to be in bed in the dark all the time.
And of course, then you get, like I had very recently, a clinician say to me at a clinical education session, oh, they're just lazy.
Mm. Yeah.
They won't get out of bed. They're just lazy.
Yeah.
It's a dreadful indictment on the medical profession. And, you know, I don't have a go at them because they need support to be able to better understand patients. But it's a dreadful comment to make and such an insult to, you know, intelligent people who the only thing they'd want to do is live a normal life and go
absolutely
back to old selves, and they're bedbound. I mean, to someone who doesn't experience it, and I don't, it is like inconceivable that someone can spend that amount of time, you know,
absolutely,
having to be in bed because your body battery is just not charging.
It's
not working properly. And, you know, I guess that's why Merge Australia changed our logo several years ago because, you know, our body is like a battery. And
absolutely.
Much easier concept to understand when you charge your battery and it isn't fully charged or it's than to try to visualize something else. Having said that, and I'm rambling, what are your thoughts on the fact that you talked about the name myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome? I mean, do you think that should be the name? I mean, the myalgic encephalomyelitis, I get, and very long word, but then it's got the chronic fatigue syndrome tagged on the end. How irritating must that be to people with ME?
It really is. I know lots of people use that term because it's easier to pronounce, and I don't want to come across as disrespectful to the people using it for that reason, but I found it created difficulties for me when I was using that term initially. People just didn't understand, and even in medical situations early on, it created misunderstanding in that sense because I would say ME/CFS. I'm like, oh, what's that? And they're like, oh, chronic fatigue syndrome. Oh, yeah, that's just, and I'm like, no, like, it's so different. And we wouldn't, like, fatigue is one aspect, but it's the post-exertional malaise that impacts everything. Like, fatigue is just one symptom, and chronic fatigue is a symptom in so many chronic illnesses. Like, it's across the board, but it's the post-exertional malaise that is why I am in bed all the time.
And it's why you're severe.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and there are gradings, I suppose, of post-exertional malaise. There are people who are very severe who,
yes,
you know, the slightest bit of activity will cause them to crash, and there's others that are a little bit less severe and
definitely
a little bit more. But the reality is that, you know, that is the defining feature of,
yes,
post-exertional malaise, which we always need to bear in mind. But it's something that is not well known by clinicians.
No, and it's something I've noticed because of the generalness in that term as well. There tends to also be misunderstanding or connection with other illnesses and things like that, whereas there are so many conditions that have an impact after exertion, and post-exertional malaise is a specific, like, physiological, biological response in itself. And so it's so complicated, and it's so difficult for people who don't fully understand it to grasp. Even our loved ones who really try to understand, you can see part of the impact, but not the full extent, because when we are most crashed is when interaction doesn't happen.
Yeah. No, I totally understand that. What are the critical needs of the severe ME community? So you're an absolutely perfect advocate of the community. What do we or the rest of us need to know about the gaps? What someone with severe, the range of issues that someone with severe ME needs, and therefore, what does an organisation, for example, like Emerge, need to do more of to better support the severe ME community? And what do governments need to do? I mean, what's the wake-up call for a government?
I think I want to first acknowledge that I'm severe, but obviously I'm able to be here having this conversation. So I don't reflect the highest needs. And so I'll try to comment as best I can from what I know, but I'm fortunate to be in a position to be able to have this conversation. In terms of what organizations like Emerge can do, the GP education and trying to connect with medical professionals and advocating for us from that sense is huge, because accessing medical care is really difficult with severe ME. Personally, I left the house once this year, and it was for an in-person appointment for my glasses, which was 2 years overdue. And I'm lucky that a lot of my other medical professionals will do telehealth, but the understanding of why that's important and having more general access to that for people with ME/CFS is important. And I think what the huge news that you shared earlier this week with us being counted now in the burden of disease, is that what it's called?
Canadian Burden of Disease Study, by the W. Yep.
That, I think, is huge. And that advocacy that's been done to get there, I think, matters a lot. And I'm hoping that that helps the government understand a little more, because there is a lot that can be done in terms of supports. Like, I'm so thankful for access to the disability support pension, but even the process of applying was so incredibly challenging as someone with severe ME on. And I was still able to look at that, and I had family support. And there are so many who don't have those supports around them, and trying to access those things, and I can't even imagine. And then on the next level of things, things like NDIS and funding in general, because of the impact of ME/CFS, there are unique needs in terms of housing and the training of support workers and having people that genuinely understand and living in a space where you are able to effectively rest and keeping in mind aspects like comorbid conditions and things like MCAS or gastrointestinal challenges, POTS and everything else that care and support needs to consider all of those elements. And it's like a spider web of needs. And there are unfortunately lots of people who are severe who struggle to access the funding or the care or the housing needs in order to be able to look after their body effectively, which then in time requires more support and more assistance. And it just is unfortunately a never-ending cycle. And yeah, that I'm hoping that the burden of disease study and including us in that is a little stepping stone in recognizing the support that can happen and with it, what Emerge is doing and the education of clinicians and things like that. If people can get diagnosed earlier and get told to rest and all of that, then maybe less people will get to a more severe state before they can get help.
Yeah, I guess the critical thing is early diagnosis, isn't it?
Because absolutely.
If we've got aware clinicians that go, this sounds a little bit like ME, let's go down that rabbit hole and see, because that'll avoid us from going down a whole lot of other rabbit holes that'll come back with a normal set of bloods,
yes,
a normal set of tests, a normal everything else, when had we gone down that ME route initially, would have taken us in a different direction and would have helped the patient sooner.
Absolutely.
It's why Emerge Australia does so much clinical education, because people like yourself and others through the telehealth line tell us constantly their number one priority is finding a doctor that believes them and understands them and doesn't slight them. So
absolutely.
The clinical education is so critical. Can I just ask you for a moment, you did mention housing. Do you ever worry about housing in terms of longer term?
Yep.
Is that because that was mentioned to me by a parent who's a kid?
Yeah.
And I just went, oh, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Then I thought, what a minefield that is.
It is. And thank you. That is a really amazing question, and it's not one I've ever been asked before, but it is a genuine concern. I personally am fortunate that just before I became unwell, I was in a position to buy my own home. So currently, I've been able to keep that. I don't know that if that will be a longer term thing or not. I don't know if it would be an appropriate place for me to ever move back to if I couldn't live here. So there are still complications with that, but be trying to keep my home for that reason was a significant stress when getting sick. And I'm lucky that I can live with family now, but obviously, you know, the things change. Like, my mum is not old at all. She's only in her 50s, but, you know, there are health things that other people need to consider, but also life, and carers need to look after themselves as well. And caring for someone with ME/CFS is challenging, and depending on their needs and things, there's a lot to consider. And housing has been a big consideration. And I know of people at the moment in Australia with ME/CFS who don't have either adequate housing or housing and are trying to find support, and the minefield of navigating that while also navigating severe ME. And it's heartbreaking because, you know, the stress of ME/CFS is one thing and the stress of housing is another, and navigating that together is...
It's challenging.
Yeah.
It's challenging, and it's challenging for an organisation like ours that works primarily in the chronic and complex condition space.
Mm.
So when you start thinking about housing, you're in a completely yeah. government department.
Absolutely.
And you're looking at it often a state issue rather than a national issue.
Yeah.
Of course, there are issues right around Australia, but the way we have to deal with some of those issues is a little bit more complicated. And so we kind of don't do anything about it. Like right now, I can say that Emerge Australia does absolutely nothing about housing. But
we can't ask an organization to cover everything, because the more the focus is spread out, the less the reach is in each of those areas. And so while Emerge hasn't been able to help in that area, the areas support is given in makes a significant difference. And I think that really matters. And if people have, you know, clinicians that understand, then that helps people apply for supports and things like that. And it does still, those stepping stones do lead to supports. And unfortunately, the current financial system overall, like the not system, how everything is financially at the moment for everyone.
Economy.
Yes, thank you. The economy is a difficult time for everyone, but obviously in those times it hits certain populations the hardest. And if the government is aware of people with ME/CFS and severe ME, hopefully that's something that can be considered, and extra supports or consideration can be looked at there.
Just supporting a service that can link to other expert services that can support, you know, because as you say, one agency can't necessarily deliver everything, but that's where partnerships come in.
And absolutely.
Australia is very, very open to partnering on areas that will round out the entire experience of someone with ME/CFS, not necessarily just across health. Just shifting a little bit, how can healthcare providers and the broader community better support individuals living with ME, you know, ensuring that they have respectful, effective care? Do you have any pearls of wisdom that we could take away from this and say, if you did this, this would be terrific?
Honestly, I think the most impactful thing that anyone can do for someone with ME/CFS is to believe us. Mm. Believe us in our experience and in what we are sharing, because that alone makes a difference. If we are believed in what we are struggling with in terms of our health, then we can get the right care from doctors, or at least look in the right direction. If we are believed by people in society, then we can access the right supports and things like that. Like, I have the most beautiful friends. I am so fortunate. And they believed me. They believed me from the beginning. And nothing was ever doubted or questioned. And that in itself made a significant impact in my transition of life, because I never had to convince them that things were hard or why there were changes. And having had difficult experiences with medical professionals in early parts of ME/CFS versus having incredibly supportive practitioners now, the ease in medical appointments when you don't have to explain what ME/CFS is, when you're believed about your symptoms, and just the overall just that in itself reduces a whole lot of pressure, because I know for me in those early days, there was so much, I had to spend so much energy advocating for myself just to get someone to believe me and to take it seriously. And if I'd had the care that I have now, the difference in that would have been huge. It's having ME/CFS in itself and all the life changes is incredibly difficult. It's really hard. And people can't reduce that difficulty, but they can not add challenges. And I think that's a big part of it. And when there's already an understanding there from healthcare providers, it helps ease a lot. Because I know for me, when I have a medical appointment, that's my, if it's online or telehealth, that's my plan for the week or the fortnight. If it's out of the house, it's even longer. And we interact with doctors more than we interact with our loved ones, really. And so having that compassion and making us feel like a person and not a number in the day makes a significant difference in not only the care we receive, but overall well-being. When you feel like you matter and someone cares.
You're validated. Your experience is validated, and you feel seen, you feel heard, you feel listened to. You know, especially for people with severe ME, that validation is so important. Absolutely. Because if you're lucky like you are, you get that validation from your family and close friends.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that, and I was reminded at a parliamentary friends group meeting that we had that a lot of people don't have that.
No, exactly.
People have suffered family breakdown, all sorts of alienation and isolation, because if there is ever a disease that isolates patients, it's this one.
Absolutely.
So, you know, some people get no validation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that has a psychological impact. And then, unfortunately, with severe ME in particular, it can be difficult to access healthcare, not just physical healthcare, but mental health care, because you have to be well enough to access that, well enough to speak to someone. And so the clinicians that people with severe ME have decided to prioritize, the bit of health that they have decided to focus on and try to get help for, is the bit that they feel will make the most difference. And even if a doctor can't specifically help in that moment, they can not add to the difficulty. They can make them feel seen. They can make them feel valued, because after that appointment, they might not speak to someone for quite some time. And I know personally, I've had difficult appointments, and then going from a difficult appointment to being in a post-exertional malaise crash alone in your room for days, not able to debrief with anyone about it or things like that, it has a significant impact. And so I think there needs to be that recognition and consideration that the patient that you're seeing or the friend that you're seeing or whatever, they are going to be in isolation for the next however long recovering from that. And what do you want to leave them with? What feeling, what memory do you want to leave? And you might not be able to leave something helpful. You might not be able to give a step forward, but you can at least make them feel valued and seen rather than adding to the difficulties.
That's just such a lovely, we're coming to the end of our almost an hour, but it's a lovely thing to start exploring at the end. You know, how do we make people, or how do we make people aware that the effort that it takes for someone with severe ME to speak on the phone or do something, will result in them feeling valued, them feeling seen and heard. I think it's a really important thing, you know, to consider. What can we do to make you feel, and patients with severe ME feel, that they are seen, that they are heard? And my question to you now is, what do you think governments need to do?
That's such a big question. I think they need to recognize the impact of post-viral illness. I know that obviously ME/CFS can have a number of things that lead to it, but post-viral illness tends to be a large factor. And yeah, acknowledgement of that and looking at ideas for prevention, and not in a way that makes people frightened, but just a general education. We are taught about the risks of speeding, of, you know, certain foods, of certain drinks, of too much sun, of so many things. We are educated about the potential impact of them so that people can make educated choices about what they do. And I think post-viral illnesses are no different. If the education is out there, then people can make educated decisions, because I personally wasn't aware that someone could get a viral infection and then end up like this. And if I had known, I probably would have approached things differently, not only prevention, but also what I did after getting sick. We have such a priority on, like, there's so much value put into productivity and pushing through. Like, it's considered the epitome of strength if you push through a challenge. But I think an overall shift in mindset there, and a focus on it's okay to rest, and rest can be productive. And that in itself could potentially have not only an impact in possible prevention or getting early care, but also for all of those already with ME/CFS and other post-viral conditions, and recognizing that rest can be valuable and you don't have to be productive to get by.
Yeah. Such important wisdom from you, Stacey. As we close out this podcast, do you have a message of hope for our listeners, especially those with severe ME?
I want to just send so much love to all of them. Like, I know that things are challenging, but I wish everyone with severe ME could know that they matter, and that their worth isn't about what they do and what they can contribute. It's there. And even in the moments they don't feel it or they can't see it, they do matter, and that there are so many people who do care and that are trying to pave a way forward. Even in the years since I was diagnosed, I've noticed a significant shift in healthcare and in what's being done, an overall awareness. And healthcare professionals that I know have reached out to me to ask about where they should go to find more information and things. And so there is a shift, and things are slow. There are people that care about them, even though they can't see it. There are so many people that care.
And even though it's slow, I mean,
yes,
the frustration that people with ME/CFS feel, you know, do we go back to the length of time it took to get a new clinical guideline? You know, it's the frustration and the hopelessness is a thing that we need to continue to keep front of mind and encourage people that have got severe ME or any form of ME or other associated condition, that things are changing slowly.
Yeah.
The opportunity is changing. Stacey, thank you so very much for giving us your time. What most people don't realize is that Stacey has severe ME. she has very gratefully for us done this interview and has been lying down for the entire time she's been speaking to us. So this is an extra special effort for you, Stacey. And so we recognize that. And we are so honored to have had this time together and really respect and are grateful for your advocacy in social media and for supporting the work of Emerge Australia across several campaigns. So we thank you for that and thank you so much again for your time, which is so valuable.
Precious. Thank you. Thank you.
That's all right. That's a pleasure. Today's podcast is part of the Emerge Australia series recorded for Severe ME Week 2026. Our podcasts continue to be a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID and overlapping conditions. As Emerge Australia concludes a federal government funding cycle and we prepare to seek renewed investment, we are proud to launch the Count ME campaign, a powerful movement to highlight the need for continued momentum and growth in support of patient services, dedicated ME research, clinical education, and health policy change for Australians living with ME/CFS, COVID, and associated energy limiting conditions. Through Count ME, we will continue to shine a spotlight on groundbreaking developments surrounding these misunderstood and stigmatized conditions and provide critical insights to equip decision makers to ensure appropriate support to effectively meet the needs of our community. Stacey, thank you so very much once again for joining me for our podcast today. And for those listening in, tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter or find out how you can support our work, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Thanks again, Stacey, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join us and the world.